There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen, and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town, everybody. We have two great guests this hour, and let's introduce them now. John Klimo is a PhD. He's also an associate professor of psychology at the American Schools of Professional Psychology at Argosy University in California. He's the author of Channeling Investigations on Receiving Channeling Space, Investigations on Receiving Information from Paranormal Sources, first published in 1987 and expanded into a new edition published by North Atlantic Books in 1998. Also joining us tonight is Pamela Ray Heath. She's also a MD and a, what is a PsyD, by the way, do you know?
Pamela, is that a psychologist?
Psychology.
Psychology, right, okay.
There we go.
She holds a doctorate in psychology. I'm not good with my abbreviations there, Pamela.
That's right.
Or I should say doctor.
Yes.
She holds a doctorate in psychology with a specialization in parapsychology from Rosebridge Graduate School of Integrative Psychology. She's the author of the PK Zone as well as journal articles on psychokinesis, place memory, and experimental research. They're both on hand tonight to discuss her new book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. And with that, I'm getting chills up my spine. And we welcome both Dr. John Klimo and Dr. Pamela Ray Heath. Good afternoon, folks.
Hello.
Or evening, whatever this is.
Yeah, whatever it is. Well, we thank you both for joining us this evening. This book was sent to me, and you know, it resonated with me because I, unfortunately, in this day and age, it seems like so many of us have had suicide touch us in our lives one way or another. And as you even mentioned in the introduction of the book, even at one point or another, we've probably all had that moment where we've considered our own mortality and if we wanted to be here anymore. And I think, you know, things that have always held us off, you know, of course, logic is one thing that keeps us from doing it, thankfully, and religious beliefs that you go straight to hell, do not pass go, do not collect $200. And you guys have put together a fascinating book that covers it from a clinical point of view, a metaphysical and a paranormal point of view, and it's just it's a great book. Again, the name of the book is Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. Let's start off with you, Dr. Klimo. What inspired you to start up on a book that would have, you know, to deal with something this impactful?
Well, for me, the story goes back to having a fellow psychologist contact me a number of years ago through a mutual friend who was contemplating killing herself and wanted to first get a second opinion from somebody who was, she was told, had done research in this area about survival of physical death and what happens after you die and a larger reality in parapsychology. And that led to our having a working for about 6 months together. I don't think she eventually killed herself. We did lose contact. But I mentioned her because the first week, between the first week and the second week she came to see me, I went to my own library and put together a bunch of pieces from different books purporting to be communications from the other side, from the afterlife, from people who have committed suicide, who then tell about the repercussions of their acts, what they met when they went to the other side, having killed themselves. And I just put these together and as a starting point, what's called bibliotherapy, something to read about and then talk about with somebody you're seeing. And that led to the conversations about should you kill yourself or not and what's going to happen if you do. And I don't know if it convinced her of anything particularly, but it was a good starting point. And that later on, the kinds of things that were put together to start that with her led to Dr. Heath developing a much more ambitious collection of these kinds of things, and then we went on from there to make it into a whole book.
Dr. Heath, did you, now I know that you're a parapsychologist as well, you've studied into this, do you have mediumistic tendencies, either you or Dr. Klimo, or were these gathered stories from other mediums and other sources that you were going out and seeking?
Well, John and I do both have some mediumistic abilities, but What we tried to do was to play this sort of dispassionate authors here, or researchers. And so we were not using our own channeled material. The only time I would say that that sort of came into play a little bit was in the last third of the book, when we got the material for the suicide bombers, we did have direct interviews with different mediums. And in some of those cases, I was sort of tuned in on both levels, on what the spirit was telling the medium directly, and then also listening to what the medium was telling me, so I could try to make sure all the information was getting relayed and that they weren't missing anything that I was picking up.
Okay. All right. So you've worked with mediums to do this and to kind of follow up, and you've collected all these stories. Now, boy, suicide, boy, this is a, you know, when we mentioned that we're going to be having somebody on talking about this and talking about what happens in the afterlife, we've had quite a mixture of different emails, from positive to negative to, you know, real concern about this subject and fear that it almost makes it seem like there is something for them to go on for, and suicide is more, it's an acceptable option. And I just want to state, you know, after reading as much of the book as I could here, that's not at all what you're trying to convey with this book, and, you know, not the message that's coming through, you know, with what the book talks about. But it helps survivors, in my opinion, to be able to get a better feel and a handle on the mindset of the people that have crossed over and where they're at and perhaps why they did what they did. Have you, Dr. Klimo, have you had a lot of experiences with family members of suicide victims that have had medium readings and made contact like this in front of you? Or is
yes,
it,
particularly okay. with the tremendous literature that's available, published literature, that that holds these stories. In other words, people who have sought help from mediums or who have gotten spontaneous communications themselves, who sort of develop a certain psychic ability just through the death of a loved one, and have sometimes it's led to a whole book being done just of somebody's son or daughter communicating back to them, who were sort of a one-off medium for the time for their own loved one to communicate to them, and then it kind of goes away after that. The important point here is that across all this literature, literally hundreds if not thousands of books and stories and published materials, let alone all the things that never got into book form, the what you hear over and over and over and over again, which we wanted to communicate, was suicide is no answer, it's no escape, it's not the way. The repercussions of suicide are pretty much uniformly negative, and hard as it is for some people feeling a lot of psycho-emotional or physical pain to believe, it seems to be better, metaphysically, spiritually, and every other way, to stay and deal with what life and has dealt you, what the universe has dealt you, rather than take an easy out. So suicide is not portrayed by us as any kind of easy out, because it's not easy. The story stays with you. You still live with your the repercussions of your acts. There is something like karma.
Okay. And that, you know, that when we brought up the mention that people were sending strange emails, one of the gals from the live chat that goes on during our show asked, she'd like to know, have you, either one of you, had any negative response from the readers of this book so far?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's run the gamut, from people who really liked it to people who were fundamentalists and really, either way, fundamentalist skeptics who don't believe it's possible for an afterlife to exist, and therefore this whole book is a joke,
right.
To those who are very entrenched that say suicides burn in hell forever and there's no hope and there's no redemption,
mm-hmm.
which is not a message that is in this book. This book says there is hope, that there is a chance for these people to sort of work off their debts and to do it again and to master their lessons and to move forward spiritually.
Do you find, being psychologists, now that's got to be a kind of strange situation for both of you, at least from my layman's view out here. You know, I'm not an expert in anything. Maybe I can change a diaper pretty quick, but that's about it, right? Do you guys find that people question your credentials being involved in the paranormal, because you are psychologists, and so much of quote-unquote the paranormal seems to be mental diseases or breakdowns, you know, everything from possession to visions and auditory and things like that. Do you find that people kind of question your, what kind of psychologist are you that this is the kind of stuff that you guys are investigating? And yeah, Dr. Heath, or, yeah, go ahead.
I think, yes, that's true. Parapsychology, although it's a member science of the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences, became that in the 60s, right alongside geology and physics and so on, is nonetheless is having to prove itself over and over again, bending over backwards to prove that it really is a science, and it looks dispassionately, neutrally, and objectively as possible, experimentally and otherwise, at non-ordinary phenomena, including survival of physical death, as well as extrasensory perception and psychokinesis and so on. And, yeah, you start off with about five strikes against you in our consensus reality and within the scientific community when you take up the torch of studying this stuff and trying to take it seriously, because most you're ganged up against by people that say it shouldn't be taken seriously or it can't be taken seriously or there's nothing to be taken seriously here. And that's not true. The more you study it, the more you see there really is something to this, at least as far as I can tell after 50 years of doing it. But you have to sort of grin and bear it and have a certain kind of a patience and tolerance and compassion for those you work with, including the fundamentalist community who not only think that you burn in hell for suicide or something like that, but also that even dealing with channeling or mediumship or the psychic, as the Old Testament warns us, is nothing but demons and wizards and you'll fry in hell for that too. That only card carrying members of the church have the right to, or saints or whatever, have the right to have commerce with a larger reality, and anybody else is either playing with fire or is being deluded or is in the possession of some kind of demons. And when you hear that over and over and over again, it's hard to have a normal conversation to have somebody look at any kind of data that might be there, mm-hmm. because that's their default setting. They keep coming back to that.
Well, you know what? I'm curious from both of you, but Dr. Heath, I'll address this question to you to start off. Dr. Klimo just made a great point with the fact of that the religious sect tells you that you're going to burn in hell for doing this and contacting the dead. I'm curious, with your studies into the parapsychology and learning more about, demonology, demons, things that are maybe not so good on the other side of the paranormal, do you ever feel that in these contacts that maybe you weren't making true contact with the spirit of the suicide victim itself, but perhaps somebody else that was trying to trick you and make it seem like things aren't so bad? And you know what I'm saying? It might give the impression that, like you said, that there's another chance. Once I'm over there, you know, I screwed up, but here's my chance. I get to, move these boulders for the next 100 years,
right,
and I get to move on.
And that's an excellent question. And one of the things we talk about in the book are the pitfalls of dealing with channeled material, because there's nothing to say that they can't lie to you or that the medium themselves might not distort things based on their own cultural beliefs and mm-hmm. biases. However, what we did is we looked at about 400 or 500 books and channel journals, including material from Swedenborg in the 1700s on up. And what we looked for was cross-corroboration. We looked for common ground where the same message came through over and over and over. And we also cross-corroborated the data where possible with near-death experiences, mm-hmm. reincarnation data, and past life hypnotherapy regression sessions. So we tried to get some sources of information that didn't rely on channels.
Okay.
And when you found that all of those say the same basic message, you can start to put some weight onto it or some rely on it a bit. But
right.
I will
separate
point
the
out
fact
that,
from fiction, sure.
Yeah, I will point out we did include a question mark in our title as to what really happens in the afterlife. We don't know for sure. None of us will until we ourselves die. But this is sort of our best guess based on the data that we were able to collect.
With the victims, the families, the survivors, who I think are the real victims of suicide, the survivors and the family that are around them, do you find that most of them do seek some kind of spiritual counseling for this to try to make communication to get the answers why? And do they often get it when they go to these mediumships, or is it more just messages of love and move on?
Well, I don't think that most people who have been personally touched by suicide, who are still alive, do go to psychics or mediums or channels. I don't think they do either because of the ethos of their own, how they've been raised and their own spiritual religious beliefs or their own and the modeling and the culture. For those reasons, they tend not to, although more and more I think people are being open to that. I think our whole culture is changing over time. But in general, I think people look for the kind of pastoral counseling, you know, from their own religious leaders or from solace from fellow members of the family, some kind of perhaps the most existential counseling to deal with the loss of someone who's killed themselves. And very often we can blame ourselves. We can think, what could I have done? I should have done something. I should have seen it coming. I was not loving enough. I was not supportive enough. And you can beat yourself about it, too. And it often helps to talk this out with someone who says, you don't need to do that to yourself. You're being unfair to yourself. They had their own life to lead. That was their own choice. Lighten up on yourself and so on. But if you don't have anybody to talk to about it, you can eat yourself up inside. And so I think it's a lot of people are just looking for, not so much for answers, but to put it to rest, to put it in some kind of a context. And that may not necessarily involve a metaphysical or let alone a psychic kind of a seeking of answers or a second opinion.
Do the spirits of suicide victims, do most of them want, I mean, are they still hanging around? Have they crossed over yet to wherever they're going, or are most of them still earthbound, have you found?
Well, they seem to go through the same basic afterlife phases that all other souls go through after they die, except that certain phases are
what are those phases?
Longer.
Yeah.
Well, they have a transition phase, and their transition phase seems to be more difficult, especially for suicide bombers, but also for traditional suicides, where they may have a lot of trouble realizing they're dead. And this is especially a problem if they're a skeptic who believed there was no such thing as an afterlife, because they still feel alive. They feel like they have a body, even though it's not a corporeal body.
Mm-hmm.
And they just can't get it through their heads they succeeded. They may try to kill themselves over and over again, thinking that they hadn't done it right the first time.
Oh, well, that's horrible.
They can also have trouble recognizing spirit helpers. Now, the spirits do what they can to try and be recognized by these people. But if they're convinced there's no afterlife and they're therefore perceptively blind to anybody coming to try to help them, that's where you may have to have spirit circles or rescue circles of psychics trying to help them understand, yes, you're dead, yes, you need to complete your transition and move on. Now, once that transition is done, they're often offered the opportunity to go to their funerals, and then there's a whole long life review and self-judgment phase. And it really is self-judgment from what we can tell. It's not somebody else judging you. However, the problem is that we're often much harsher judges on ourselves.
Right, I would think that would be more of a hell. Sure.
So the spirit guides will try to point out the positive, you know, not just the negatives of what we did, but also the positives to give us a balanced approach. And then there's the question of spiritual work, which many suicides will actually choose either to go back and act as guardian angels for the living or to act as spirit guides for other newly dead suicides, or they'll take some other courses of action as a form of penance in a way and spiritual work. And
well,
then
I don't mean to sound cynical here, and pardon me, but you know, I don't know that I want my guardian angel to be somebody that was so screwed up that they let go of their own lives.
What?
You know what I'm saying? I mean, to me, that seems kind of a strange
where they
philosophy.
Tend to do it is they are in a position of, you know how it is if somebody says, well, you aren't in my shoes. You don't know what I'm going through.
Right.
You can't tell me what to do. Well, if they're dealing with a suicide, they can honestly say, yeah, I've been in your shoes.
Okay.
I know what you're going through. And brother, let me tell you, this is a mistake.
But
don't
once they've
it.
Crossed over, they're given some type of enlightenment, you feel, so they understand how maybe to... You understand what I'm saying? I mean, you're counselors, you're psychologists.
Right.
You know what's going on. You know the psychology of this. To have Tim try to counsel me in marriage, and he's never been married...
It's not right away.
Right,
It's part of what goes on after the life review and self-judgment. There is a certain amount of enlightenment or learning that goes on during that phase. And you have to understand, it's not just going through your life one time. You may go through it repeatedly, trying to get into deeper and deeper levels of understanding and meaning as to what choices you made, what were the ramifications of that, how did that affect everybody around you, living it in their shoes so that you can really feel what was the effect of what you did. There's a tremendous amount of learning in this.
All right. Well, for those of you that are just tuning in, you're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Our guests this evening are Dr. Pamela Ray Heath and Dr. John Klimo. They've written a book called Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. We'll be back more to talk with the doctors and talk about this fascinating book. We'll do that right after this. Good evening and welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Tonight we're taking a little bit more of a serious look at a very serious subject. On hand with us we have Dr. Pamela Ray Heath and Dr. John Klimo, who are on hand with their book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the different transitionary periods that spirits go through and how they sometimes, I guess, is that what you call, Dr. Heath, karma, the way that they come back and become guardian angels or guiding
spirits?
It's spiritual
work. It's a matter of choice on their part.
Okay. All right. And I'm sorry, Dr. Klimo, before we were going off to the break, you started to say something. I'm sorry I interrupted you to go to the break, but what did you have a point you wanted to make there?
In the flow of things, it was on the tip of my tongue. I can't remember now what it was.
Okay. Well, we'll come back. I'm sure we'll pop it in. Now, going through this, do you both, I guess I'm curious, after writing this book and putting all this together, do you have a better feeling for what happens after we die? Yourself. I know that there's still questions and we'll never really know, but do you both feel a sense of security having a little bit of a better handle on what happens once we go on?
I'll let John answer that first.
Okay. Well, I've worked with survival research, including electronic phenomenon. In other words, trying to get using radio and tape recorders and television and stuff to try to get some kind of more recorded communication from the other side as well. And as a parapsychologist, so I've been working with channeling for 25, 30 years as a phenomenon, and having written a definitive book on it. So I've sort of been living with death and its repercussions. And so what happens after you die, purportedly happens after you die, what the afterlife is like, residence of the afterlife, relationship between those who've survived and those who are still in physical bodies like ourselves, that's all pretty much deeply ingrained in me. And I guess I could say after all this time, even though I've not had much personal direct experience, it's seeped in like through scholarship, just the inductively, the hundreds if not thousands of cases and stories and reports and data and the commonality of it all. I have a well-ingrained understanding for me personally, or let's say a faith or a belief, about what happens after you die. What this book did, what working on this particular project did, was give me the increased depth of understanding about the suicide part of it, the ethical part, the should you do it, the should, the ought, and not so much what we human beings, either on this side or the other side, say about that, but really essentially what the universe seems to say, what's the ultimate truth of it is. And I think that the universe is a benevolent spiritual domain, and that's ever deeper in me after the writing of this book and doing all the research on it. That is that it's not a punishing Old Testament Yahweh run universe, the fire and brimstone and,
sure,
and the negativity and the punishment and so on. It's really there's forgiveness, there's understanding, there's support, there's second chance. Essentially, we're immortal spirits that can deal with what we're being given to deal with, to grow soul, to evolve our spirits. And one of the harshest things we can deal with is self-murder, suicide, and the murder of others, like the terrorist suicide bombers. And if you get to the gnarly guts of that and can still come out of it saying, gee, what this seems to say, when you really get in and look at it carefully, is that it is a loving, spiritual, benign universe, and that makes me feel better about my own life, or if I'm going to be murdered, or if I'm facing people that I think are like lost souls here and in physical embodiment, that we're all on the path of evolving our souls toward God consciousness or whatever, and sure, we're fallible and faltering along the way, and we kill ourselves and each other on the way, but it's not a one-shot thing. We're basically immortal spirits on this path of evolvement, and so if you put a bullet through your head at one point, it isn't the end totally of your story. It's a chapter, and you can learn from the chapters as you go into the next episode, the next learning round.
You know, the one thing that I find, again, just kind of being a layman here, and you know, I've got somewhat of a religious background and growing up Lutheran and going to, you know, Lutheran grade school and being taught the fire and brimstone side of this. It almost, you know, what's almost infuriating or more irritating to me about this whole deal is the fact that for so long we were taught to believe that, especially with murder, that they'll get theirs on the other side. But it almost sounds like, well, they get theirs, but they get a chance to redeem themselves and... You know, justice is not truly served in the vein that we were brought up believing. And I don't mean that to sound bitter. I mean, I unfortunately am the survivor, if you will, of a friend that was brutally murdered along with two of her children. And, you know, I've always kind of consoled myself with, well, they're going to contend with that when they go. They're going to have to deal with that. But, you know, after kind of speaking with both of you, it almost sounds like there's a chance for redemption for them afterwards, and maybe justice isn't so swift for people that have done crimes like that.
Well, I would say...
The moral of the story is they do have to contend with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple things. First of all, one of the lessons, I think, that I got from the spirit realm in doing this book is that we all need to be less judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
We don't necessarily know what all the factors were going into a situation. They will have to live through everything they did to somebody else. They'll have to live through... not only the death of your friend, but how that death impacted every single person in her life, and how that death, you know, how it changed things. If she would have lived, you know, what was taken away from every single person they could have come into contact with. You're talking about a very grueling, difficult thing to do.
Okay, well, see, now that would make me feel better. And again, I don't mean to sound vindictive or judgmental on it, but again, you just have that, you know, in that sense of your own life of, you know, there has to be a justice. Now, when you say that they relive this or they feel this, you're saying that they actually, it's almost like, to me...
As if it was them.
Right, as if, okay, so they're almost reliving the life themselves.
Right.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, that's part of the learning process, is to really, to fully understand what they've done to someone else. It's as if... You know, they go through it as if it was them.
Mm.
So it's as if they were murdering themselves.
Oh, wow.
And they go through the pain. So trust me, this is not a lightweight thing. And certainly for the suicide bombers, you're talking, when you talk about mass murder, you're talking about a tremendous number of lives they're going to have to go through. And this is not a fast process. This can take thousands of years.
Wow.
So we're not talking about, you know, quick and simple here. But I do think that, you know, I learned certain lessons more about life than death in doing this book. Both how major it is that we create our own realities on all levels of existence. We see what we expect to see, and we're blind to what we want to ignore. And also how important it is to recognize that our actions affect others. We have to be very mindful of our decisions and make thoughtful choices, because we're responsible for their impact. There's consequences and repercussions. So I would say writing the book had more of an effect on how I look at life than how I necessarily look at death.
And that was a great point that you brought up. Thank you very much for that. And Dr. Kleeman, you were about to say something?
A couple of years ago, I had a doctoral student who did her dissertation on an emerging area of the criminal justice system that surprisingly has not really caught on that much yet, which is rather than just take somebody who's done something wrong or bad, whether it's a murder or whatever, or something less, right down to graffiti, And rather than just slap their wrist or put them in a slammer for a little while or maybe, you know, execute them through capital punishment and put their lights out, so to speak, that this approach confronts the perpetrator with the victim. And you are forced to deal with your victim and the victim's family. I mean, if you didn't kill yourself or them or their survivors, and you have to work with them and put it to right. You have to do what is necessary to balance this out and to pay back. It may not be financially, it may be in other ways, but also to have it sink into you the repercussions of your acts. And I think that's kind of a microcosm of this larger kind of cross levels of reality perspective we're talking about here, that the universe is so designed that if you do something as drastic as kill yourself or kill someone else, they're part of the teaching methodology of the universe, of God, of the spiritual hierarchy, whatever you want to call it, has built into it this educational process and if you want to talk about how prisons don't try to help the people there, don't try to show them the light, don't try to rehabilitate them, don't try to train them to when they get out, you know, to survive on their own, and it certainly doesn't. That in a sense, in a metaphysical level, we're looking at a universe that, based upon all the stories and all the data that we have, that you are worked with to see through the eyes of others, to have ending up to true understanding and compassion about what you did. And what you should have done and not done, and nobody is kind of preaching at you with veins standing out in their neck and proselytizing. It's a very subtle, multidimensional way you're being shown the truth of what you shouldn't have done, and it's not just a one-dimensional kind of a thing. It's rather profound. It's like no big computer in the sky could really do it. It's like a universal mind, a universal justice system. That's what I saw underneath so many of these little stories.
When the people are channeling the victims of the suicide, are the messages always profound? Are the spirits still angry? Are they still hurt? Are they still, or is it yes because they go through different levels?
Yeah, it runs the gamut depending on how evolved they are. And if you're talking about early on, a lot of times there's anger on the part of perpetrators. There may be a refusal to admit they did anything wrong, and a lot of defiance. And then as things develop, you know, as they get farther along, the messages are more about love or being mindful of one's actions and how it affects others. I think one thing a lot of people don't quite understand is that even though they may have crossed over to the other side, they are still very aware of those of us in the physical realm. And if we're angry at them or if we're feeling guilty, they'll feel that. They feel those emotions.
And they
may feel them even stronger than we feel them.
Do they come then, do you believe, as a guardian angel for the people, the survivors?
They sometimes
help them through the situation?
And they sometimes come, I think, to family members in dreams.
Mm-hmm.
To talk to them, to let them know, you know, they're okay, or to pass on other messages. Mostly they want those left behind know that they're loved. They still love them, even though they've crossed over.
Do you feel that time is relevant in the afterlife as it is here? Is 1,000 years to them the same? Are they learning all of this but going through hell, but then they're able to come back enlightened at the same point that they died so that they can be here for the survivors?
No, it takes a long time.
Time is different in the other continuum, in the other level of reality. That seems to be pretty clear from all the research, all the data. Anybody, any of your listeners who've had a close brush with death, you know, they almost die in a car accident, or
mm-hmm.
they sort of, their life flashes in front of them, so to speak. It's not like a life review on the other side, but it can be. And a near-death experiencer can sometimes describe this. But one of the things that's described, like you're in a car accident, and everything slows down,
mm-hmm.
and you're able to have a lot more time to reflect on what's going on. Look at that thing slowly turning over. Look at the color of that. Your life can flash in front of you, so to speak, and you see in great detail a bewildering, staggering amount of of sequential material about your own life, like videoic a replay, and yet the whole thing is happening in a matter of seconds, perhaps. And so obviously something is out of sync between objective time space on this level of reality and what it is once you kind of get out of your body or detach from the normal physical continuum. And certainly on the other side, 5 years here it can be 5 minutes there, or it's like subjective space time. It's like when you go inward meditatively. It's not the same as clock time.
You know, you just gave me the willies there, Dr. Klimo, because I got to tell you, I had a car accident about 4 or 5 years ago with my son in the car, and we were driving. It was icy out, and we were on a really busy two-lane highway, and our car spun. And when I would look up out the window, things were going at Mach speed, but inside the car, it was a totally different pace. And I literally, I put my arm out across my son, and we looked at each other, and I said, "Boy, I'm really sorry about this." And he said, "Why, Dad?" And I said, "Because we're going to get hurt here, and I'm really sorry, son. I want you to know I love you, and I hope everything comes out of this okay." And he said, "Don't worry, Dad. It'll be okay." And I said, "All right, well, we'll see." And I said, "Just hold on, okay?" And we had this whole, what felt like a two-minute conversation as my car kept spinning in donuts in traffic on an icy road. We launched off and went down into this ravine and came up and almost into the other lane of highway when our car stopped. And we looked at each other, and the one thing that we both talked about and walked away from that deal was, in the span of our car, time was totally irrelevant. When we would literally look out the window, it was spinning like we were going to Mach speed that we felt we were, but talking to one another, there was all this time. It was very surreal, very unreal situation. So you feel
wonderful
that,
story.
And it was. My son and I still laugh about it to this day. He's 18 years old, and they'll go, "Remember that, Dad? That day, Dad?" And we were just like, "Yeah, hey, how about the game? Oh, yeah, it's going to be." We were just so very nonchalant, and there was no panic. There was no real fear. It was just like, "Ah, crap, we're going to die. Hey, I'm really sorry about this," you know? And we just kind of lived it out. But, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me, that time kind of changes its relevance in the face of death. And luckily nothing happened. We didn't even get impacted. Nobody touched us, and we were on a busy road. I don't understand how we continued to spin in front of cars and just keep moving forward and then go down to the ravine. It was a strange situation, but that is, you know, the whole time continuum just kind of boggles my mind with it. And as you're saying, there is a definite difference in the next reality, if you will, correct?
I mean, one of the things that Pam and I have, and other parapsychologists have come to realize, is that if you're talking with someone, or someone's coming to you, who's had personal experience of whatever kind, of the paranormal in general, let's say, the otherworldly, the larger reality, the scientifically inexplicable, the awesome, whatever, that it's different than if they've not had personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
If you've not had personal experience, and it's only book learning or what the Bible told you or you learned in school or whatever, or what the scientific community in its wisdom has said is the invariable truth, then you have a different relationship with the phenomenon, with the personal experience that you've had. And yet with suicide, you've got a problem. Or with survival of physical death, you have a problem, because how many people, you know, can say, "Well, I've had that experience, and so I've been changed by it, and I know the truth of it now, and nobody can convince me otherwise because it's in my bones and it's in my lived experience."
Mm-hmm.
One of the few areas where this is true is the near-death experience, where somebody can attempt suicide and be unsuccessful at it, and then come back to tell the tale, including having kind of touched the other side, stepped 1 foot over it, seen loved ones, had the parts of the death experience that are normally described by people from the other side who were successful in their deaths or their suicides, but then are told, "No, it's not your time yet. You need to come back. You have unfinished business."
Right. Well, you're listening to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show, and our guest this evening is Dr. Pamela Ray Heath and Dr. John Klimo with their book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. We're going to get a little bit more into this when we come back. We have about 15 minutes left in the show. We'll talk a little bit more about it and find out maybe a little bit more of the perceptions of what happens when we are gone. We'll be back with that right after this. Good evening and welcome back to the Darkness on the Edge of Town Paranormal Radio Show. Our guests this hour have been Pamela Ray Heath and Dr. John Klimo with their book, Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead. The book is available at just about any book dealer. Is that right, doctors?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay, so you can pick it up anywhere. You can also, we have a link on our website, so you can go there and click it and pick up a copy of the book. And I got to tell you, this is a hot topic. We get a lot of people going on all kinds of sides while we're watching in the live chat room and looking on the other boards that we're part of here. Tim has some questions, and after reading some of the parts of the book, I know that you cover this, so I'm going to let him talk about it because this is a lot of questions that are coming up in our chat room, so I'll be quiet and divert it over to Tim here.
Well, doctors, the one thing that I guess we're trying to avoid, and this is coming up a lot in the chat room, it has to do with religion, but I want to kind of turn your attention to 9/11. Here's a situation where you had thousands of people who died who were innocent victims. You had suicide bombers who flew airplanes into towers. With the idea that once they do this, they'll be rewarded with whatever it is, 1,000 virgins and milk and honey, and everything will be fine on the other side if they make the sacrifice in the name of what they believe in. And technically, you could say that their cause is a religion as well. Or it's something that they deeply believe in enough to take their own life. My question to both of you, and we'll start with Dr. Klimo, is technically, in our eyes, they're criminals. In their eyes, they're martyrs. What happens to them when they get to the other side?
Well, on Earth, before they commit the deed, they're martyrs and they're heroes and they're jihadists and they're fighting a holy war, and they have a context within which to explain this and to justify themselves and to even make themselves heroes. But when they get to the other side, it all sort of falls apart. I mean, there are no virgins. There is no welcoming Allah saying, "You did well, my son." It's a vacancy. That isn't the case. And there's the beginnings of a long, prolonged, it seems, having to deal with what they did when they now see that all their schooling, all their conditioning, all in the subculture, the extremists, the fundamentalist, terrorist trained subculture, is really that they were taught something that really isn't true. Maybe religion says we survive physical death, that there is a God, and so on. And whether it's an Islamic situation with Allah or a Christian one, I think there is a commonality across all the religious spiritual points of view. But when you try to justify your own death or taking the lives of others, as the Islamic have done. I mean, the topical part of our book was that we thought it was timely to do this book now, and a third of the book is devoted just to this. I mean, there must be 50, 60 pages in it just about the suicide bombers and the Islamic point of view and how they've been trained to look at this kind of stuff and what jihad and holy war really mean.
Sure.
And yet we also interviewed and looked at the literature of a whole legion of Islamic clerics and holy men and scholars who, to the person, said, no, Muhammad did not say that. No, the Quran does not say that. You should never kill. You should never kill yourself. You should never kill another. But there's this loophole under jihad that you can wage a holy war, and including not just on the infidels or the Christians, but you can do it with between the Shiites and the Sunnis, for God's sakes, and kind of infighting and think that justifies killing, killing others.
What?
And so, I think that it is criminal, and there is no justification for taking the life of another. And not only that, but if you do that in a suicide bombing situation or in a murder or in a murder suicide, a moment of passion, you find that you're not let off the hook. It isn't like you just snuffed and you go into an abyss and you get off. You don't get off. The thing continues to unfold. It's a live, living thing you're embedded in, and you are the author of your own reality, and having done something as horrific as being responsible for one life, let alone thousands of lives, for God's sakes, is going to stay with you, in a sense, eternity.
Well, I have a quick question for this, and maybe, Dr. Heath, maybe you can follow this up for us. Now, I know this doesn't play too deeply, and I'm just kind of curious, are you a religious person yourself?
I would call myself a very spiritual person.
Okay. The question I have for is, we're brought up to believe that God, our being, our greater being, is loving, passionate, and forgiving. If I am brought up in a third world country where I never got to hear about Christianity or the path of Jesus Christ or peace or love or whatever, I was brought up to believe that killing these infidels would be spiritual heaven for me, and I would be brought there. Do you believe that there's a certain level of forgiveness from the Creator, whatever it may be, that how can I punish somebody whose only beliefs and only thing that they were ever taught was this lifestyle? This is the way it is. And when you're brought up to believe that, it's okay. And I'm not coming down on the side of the terrorists here, but I'm just kind of curious if in the whole karmic justice thing, how do you feel the gavel of justice comes down on them?
Well, as I mentioned before, everybody judges themselves. The catch to this, however, is that the spirit realm does not let you quit the judgment phase until they think you've got it right. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the suicide bombers will be the ones ultimately realizing or having to recognize they screwed up. And this is not going to be a quick process from what we can tell.
Right.
It's going to be a very slow process. But that's part of what they're going to have to go through. And as every human being knows, the hardest thing for us to do is to forgive ourselves for our mistakes. It's easier to forgive somebody else for hurting us than to forgive ourselves for screwing up.
Okay, so I address this both to Dr. Klimo and Dr. Heath. So the suicide bomber's gone through this. They're in the afterlife. They're going through the judgmental process. What happens with a religion that doesn't believe in reincarnation? You've got someone who's done this deed. They believe they're going to be rewarded. They're not rewarded. Eventually, even if they believe in reincarnation or not, does that soul stay trapped in the hereafter? Or do they come back to try and relive their life to undo what they've done?
Well, you can... Whether you believe, going into death, whether you believe in reincarnation or not, is sort of beside the point that once you get over to the other side,
right.
If reincarnation is an option, that's not something, that's something that you or your own higher self or your
right.
own afterlife self is going to have to work out with spirit guides and hierarchy or whatever.
It's like you don't need to believe in reincarnation because reincarnation believes enough in you, right?
Right.
So you're going to go there, and it's going to happen whether you want it to or not.
True. And part of the multi-leveled, multi-dimensional afterlife or larger universe in which we reside and continue to learn and grow and experience is a lesson learning kind of school for soul growth, including in the discarnate realm as well as the incarnate realm. And you don't have to kind of necessarily reincarnate into a physical body and live another kind of amnesically blocked lifetime to learn these things and to continue this path. You can also continue to do it on the astral plane or the mental plane or as you evolve within the non-physical domains, according to all this literature. And so whether you stay over there or reincarnate back, you're still dealing with deepening the understanding. So like you're growing yourself into being an angel or a god with a small g. And that takes a hell of a long time to iron out the bumps, you know, and to become essentially saintly or truly loving and compassionate and omniscient and omnipotent and especially omnibenevolent. And if you're a suicide bomber, you know you're a kindergarten and if you were denied any larger understanding or schooling or modeling on Earth in just a very closed, constrained fundamentalist situation. On the other side, you're then slowly, over time, given the opportunity to be taught and shown and given more chances to have experiences through which you can become a more full and deep and rich and loving soul than you ever could on Earth when you were cooked up in a little Skinner box where you didn't have a chance to
right.
eat and think straight.
Well, Dr. Heath and Dr. Klimo, we have about a minute and a half left. I'm sorry the time went by so quickly for us, but if you could leave us both with a thought. What's something that you want to pass on to people that have either survived suicide and are curious about what's going on or people that are considering suicide? Dr. Heath, why don't we start with you for the closing?
There's a whole chapter in the book devoted to just messages from people who committed suicides to those who are thinking about it. I'd ask them to read that chapter. It makes it very clear it's not a solution. They're not going to get what they want if they kill themselves. It's better to live their lives.
All right. And Dr. Klimo?
But as I said before, that everything points to the realization that it's a multidimensional, spiritual, living universe, a loving universe in which we're embedded as little subsets of that, as emerging realizations of that universal realization, of that God consciousness, and to get a little taste of that, to have a dawning sense of that on Earth, whether we're thinking of killing ourselves or killing someone else, we might count to 10 first, and have that. We hope that our book would give a little more shed a little more light on the context within which you might be taking your own life or someone else's life. That it really is a true spiritual reality we're embedded within, and that's different than just, oh, I can just kill myself or kill someone else.
Well, doctors, I can't thank you enough for being brave enough to come out with a book like this. It's very intriguing, it's interesting, and hopefully it can help a lot of people that have had suicide touch their lives, either in the thoughts that they have about creating or doing suicide or murder, or people that are survivors from this. And again, the name of the book is Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, Channeled Conversations with the Dead, by Pamela Ray Heath and John Klimo. And for those of you that are having problems and you are facing depression and suicide is an option in your mind right now, know that there are people that care about you and it will have a deep impact. Please give a call to 1-800-SUICIDE. That's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. You can check them out at hopeline.com. Again, that's 1-800-SUICIDE, and you can check them out at www.hopeline.com. Your friends at Darkness Radio worry about you. Please take care of yourself and those around you. Seek help. Thank you, and we'll be back with you again next week. Thank you, Dr. Heath and Dr. Klimo, for joining us this evening.